Hello, Dreamers, and welcome back to the show. This is the second part of a two-part series on the recent conviction of disgraced South Carolina attorney Alec Murdoch. If you haven't listened to part one, which is episode 255, then pause this, go and listen to that one first, and then come back. We left off last time with the investigation into the shootings and all of the cell phone data that provided all sorts of pertinent information regarding everyone's movements and cell phone activity in the time leading up to and following the murders. We left off with Alec getting back to the Moselle property after fake visiting his mom and then supposedly happening onto the bodies of his wife Maggie and his son Paul, who, according to Alec, just got shot to death in that narrow window of time between him leaving for his mom's house and coming back. Alec would hang on to that alibi story for a while. That is, until he couldn't. When video evidence from Paul's phone proved that not only was Alec not just in the proximity of the shooting when it happened, but he was actually right there at the kennels within minutes of the shootings, a thing that he first denied that would later be proven to be a lie, as Alec's voice was captured on a video Paul took that was discovered once investigators were able to unlock Paul's iPhone. Alec would later change his story publicly for the first time when he took the stand in his own defense at his trial in February of 2023. The cell phone evidence forced Alec to admit that not only was he at the kennels moments before the shooting, but also that he lied about it for months to the police. Where we left off in part one was when Alec got back to make this gruesome discovery, and he was caught in a bunch more lies when he said that when he got there, Paul and Maggie weren't at the house, so he drove his vehicle back down to the kennels. He initially claimed that he got out of his vehicle, he checked on both of the victims for signs of life, that he tried turning Paul over by pulling on his belt loops, but I guess ended up leaving him face down. But when he did try to turn Paul over, his cell phone fell out of his pocket, so he picked it up. All of this while observing pieces and bits of Paul's brain and skull scattered all around the sidewalk, and then he had the wherewithal to place Paul's phone back on top of his body. All of these actions were said to be a part of Alec's alibi. But the problem here is the time between Alec putting his OnStar tracked vehicle in park near the kennels and his call to 911 amounted to only about 20 to 22 seconds. This again contradicting Alec's story that he parked, got out of the car, checked for signs of life, tried turning Paul over, observing Paul's phone falling out of his pocket, picking it up, placing it back down, then calling 911. Alec would also amend this story on the stand by saying that he was doing all of those things while on the phone with 911, and when I watched this segment of his testimony, he started to have a little bit of a foggy memory, like he didn't know what was happening, which is understandable when you discover two of your loved ones dead. So now we're about to get into why Alec picked up Paul's phone in the first place, and the phone calls that Alec was attempting to make to the last person Paul had been in contact with before he was murdered, and that would be Rogan Gibson. Let's pick up our story from there. Before we get to Alec's Oscar-unworthy performance, we have to talk a little bit about the matter of Mr. Rogan Gibson, Roro, as Alec so disgustingly, affectionately referred to him as, along with Paul, Mags, Bus, Roro. It's like, oh, what an asshole, right? Knowing what we know and then using these terms of endearment for these people. I mean, I have nicknames for my favorite people and my pets. I call my daughter Evelyn. I'm kidding. Sometimes I just call her Ev. I call Fred, Fredward, or Chubbs. I just happen to call Rhoda, my little puppy Rhoda. I call her Roro sometimes. And Ricky is my little dingbat. But because we know that Alec murdered his wife and his son, it's just really gross for him to sit up on that stand and use these nicknames for everybody. Because I can't with this guy. But anyway, Rogan was Paul's friend, and actually, based on Buster Murdoch's testimony, Paul's older brother, I tend to believe that Rogan was even more of his friend than Paul's. But either way, he was the owner of the dog that the Murdochs were keeping kenneled for him at the Moselle property, because where he was living, he couldn't have his dog. In the time leading up to his father shotgun blasting him to death, Paul had been in a back and forth conversation with Rogan about his dog's tail. Rogan was worried about it, and he wanted to get a friend of his girlfriend's to take a look at it because she's a veterinarian. However, because Paul was gunned down by his dad, the conversation suddenly went radio silent on Paul's end. Of course, Rogan has no idea that this is going on, so he had been waiting to receive the video that Paul said that he was going to send him of the dog's tail, but that video obviously would never be sent. At 9:34 p.m., about 44 minutes after the time it is believed that Paul and Maggie were gunned down, Rogan sent a text to Maggie asking her to tell Paul to call him. Of course, again, Rogan has no idea that she's dead too, and that text that he sent to her would never be read. Another important thing about Rogan having been in contact with Paul leading up to his murder is that Alec had no idea how much or how little Rogan knew about his presence at the dog kennels minutes prior to the shootings. Just like Alec didn't know, Maggie had told, I believe it was her sister, that Alec had asked her to come to the Moselle property that evening because his father's health had taken a turn for a worse that day. Maggie wasn't staying at Moselle at the time. She retreated from her husband and her son and all the chaos that had been involving Mallory and possibly Alec's financial malfeasance if she knew about it. She was staying at their beach property. But whatever her reasons were, Maggie was putting distance between herself and her husband, so he used his father's ailing health to lure her back to the Moselle property, figuring that she would go there out of sympathy for him. And just like I said in the last episode, I wish things would have gone differently, but you know, Alec at this point was going to grow increasingly more desperate with each passing day. Paul's court hearing was looming. Alec had just been confronted about missing money from the firm. He was going to be made to answer to his shady finances because he and Paul were going to be held accountable for the boat crash and Mallory's death. And the biggest problem Alec Murdoch has always had is that Alec has always been the most important person to Alec. And for some reason, he arrived at the conclusion that the only way to get rid of his problems was to get rid of Paul. And what about Maggie? Why did she have to die too? Perhaps she knew about what was going on with Alec's embezzlement, and if Paul was murdered, she would likely, possibly very quickly, join the anti-Alec brigade. She was the closest person to him. She probably knew too much. And if he were to just murder Paul, and if she even suspected Alec had something to do with it, she would have turned on him in a hot second. So, about a minute after Rogan sent that text message to Maggie asking her to ask Paul to call him, Alec's phone started recording his steps again. He's leaving his mom's house after about a 15 to 20 minute visit. The whole time she was asleep. At 9:43 p.m., this would be approximately 53 minutes after it is believed Paul and Maggie were shot, Alec shifted his vehicle out of park. 54 seconds later, he put it back into park. Close to a minute later, he took it out of park again. Almost 2 minutes later after that, at 9:46 p.m., Alec tried calling Paul's phone. This connection lasted 18 seconds, and this call was deleted from Alec's phone log. Another minute later, Alec sent a text to Maggie that said, "Call me, babe." She doesn't read it because, of course, she's dead. 5 minutes after that, at 9:52 p.m., slightly over an hour since the murders, Alec sent his friend, Chris Wilson, a text asking if he's up or to call him if he's up. Chris called twice. The first call, Alec didn't answer. The second one, he did. Chris wanted to talk about work, but Alec was almost back at the Moselle property and told him that he would call him back. And again, like in the first part where Alec was speeding towards his mom's house, he again was speeding as he drove home. At 9:56 p.m., Alec's phone recorded him taking steps once again. So now Alec is either at or about to get back to the Moselle property, and he has to make this horrifying discovery and the 911 call. At 9:57 p.m., 23 minutes after Rogan sent Maggie the text asking her to tell Paul to call him, Rogan called Paul's phone but received no answer. 1 minute later, Rogan sent a text to Paul that said, "Yo." At 10 p.m., 70 minutes after the murders, Alec's vehicle is back at Moselle and he puts it into park at the main house on the property. Over the next couple minutes, Alec took his car out of park 3 times and put it back into park 2 times near the main house. The final time he took it out of park was at 10:04 p.m. 1 minute later, Rogan called Paul's brother Buster, but that connection only lasted 2 seconds. Almost simultaneously to that, Alec was driving his vehicle from the main house towards the dog kennels. 50 seconds later, Alec put his vehicle into park near the kennels. 20 seconds after that, Alec called 911 and made a 7-minute call to report that he had discovered Maggie and Paul had been shot. This is the 20 seconds I talked about in the opening. This 20 seconds between the time Alec put his vehicle into park and the time he called 911 came back to bite Alec in the butt later on at trial. Because Alec, Mr. Smarty Pants Know-It-All, gave the police a story about what he did when he discovered the bodies of his wife and son. But it would turn out that he would make his 911 call way too fast for him to have done all of those things that he claimed to have done when he found them. Alec said he checked for signs of life and that he tried to turn Paul's body over. He said he checked to see if Paul was breathing, that he checked if Maggie was breathing, and then he called 911. 20 seconds just simply wasn't enough time, which meant Alec did not do all of those things, and even if he did, he lied about when he did them. He knew that there would be no signs of life because he had gone and killed them more than 70 minutes earlier. He called 911 as soon as he put his car into park, not leaving himself enough of this alibi time because he didn't take into consideration that his vehicle's OnStar would be able to tell a different story. Let's talk a little bit about the 911 call. This call that Alec made was all about him, which had pretty much been the theme of Alec's entire life. So it does not surprise me one bit that the first thing Alec did on the 911 call was introduce himself. "This is Alec Murdoch," he said. That was Alec's power move his entire life. Everything he did from the very beginning early on, if he wanted to cut in the lunch line at school, "I'm Alec Murdoch." He wants to get a date with the captain of the cheerleading squad, "I'm Alec Murdoch." He wants to get a good grade in political science 101, "I'm Alec Murdoch." He wants to get out of a speeding ticket, "I'm Alec Murdoch." He wants to represent your wrongful death case so he can rip off all your settlement money and there's nothing that you could do about it because, "I'm Alec Murdoch." Alec wants someone else to take the blame for his son's boating while under the influence that ended up killing someone, and it's not because he's trying to protect his son, but because, "I'm Alec Murdoch." "I'm going to fleece the firm that my great-grandfather founded for as much money as I possibly can because, "I'm Alec Murdoch." "I'm going to murder my F-up of a son and his mom for good measure in order to distract everyone from my F-ups because, "I'm Alec Murdoch." "Then I'm going to stage my own suicide to try to look like a homicide in order to leave my eldest son behind to carry on the legacy of our good name." Just kidding. "I'm going to fake the whole thing and pretend I'm doing the honorable thing by my family, doink myself on the head, create some weird superficial wound, cry like a bitch on the phone that someone just tried to call me so everyone will feel sorry for me and forget that I'm a lying, cheating, stealing family annihilator because I'm Alec Murdoch." Yeah. How well is that working for you, Alec? One of the things that Alec did get right, in terms of putting together his alibi, is that he did make sure that he started the fake crying while on the 911 call while the phone was ringing. Going back again to the Pam Hupp story, if you remember that crazy ass 911 call she made when she was about to get ready to shoot and kill Louis Gumpenberger, she dialed 911 and made the mistake of not realizing that the recording of the call starts as soon as the call is connected, not when the dispatcher picks up the phone. So Pam was supposedly in this life or death struggle with Louis, but prior to the dispatcher picking up the call and asking what the emergency was, there was dead silence on the line on Pam's end while the ringing was happening. All of that was recorded. As soon as the dispatcher answered, it was like a director calling action, and then suddenly Pam launches into this really fake, "Hey, help, help." It was one of the stupidest, fakest 911 calls in the history of stupid, fake 911 calls. At least Alec started his fake sobbing during the ringing, if that's something that we can consider having been done right to begin with. "This is Alec Murdoch," he said. And then he says, "I need the police and an ambulance immediately." He's the one that needs the ambulance and the police, right? Not his son or his wife. He needs them. And then he says, "My wife and son were just shot badly." How the hell does he know, one, that they were just shot, and two, that they were shot, period? I guess maybe Alec would know what it looks like right away to be shot, what those wounds would look like as an attorney and an avid hunter. He would probably know better than the average layperson. But Alec certainly wouldn't know that they were just shot. So right off the bat, he knows too much information. Also, if Alec needed the police and ambulance immediately, like he stated, then why the hell would he introduce himself first? This is Alec Murdoch. I've talked about a 911 call that I made probably more than a year ago now or so. Many of you remember, and if you don't, I'll tell you now. There was this guy that was knocking at my door. I couldn't tell who it was. I thought it was a delivery, but because of my dogs barking so much, I couldn't speak to the person through the door. And I could see through the window that there was somebody there, and I thought, my first thought, that it was a delivery. So when I cracked the door open, and I do that to not let the dogs out, to see who it was, this man started to try to shove his way into my apartment. Because this man was either high or intoxicated or both, he then kind of fell over onto my patio chair, and that's when I managed to get the door shut and I deadbolted it. When I called 911, the first thing I said was, "There's a guy trying to get through my front door. He tried pushing his way in. I got the door closed and locked, but he keeps trying to knock and turn the knob." That's when the dispatcher asked for the address of my location. I didn't think to give that information first. I just said what was happening. But I certainly didn't freaking introduce myself first. "This is Roseanne Sinclair. I'm a Sagittarius. I have 3 dogs, 1 kid and a podcast. I love pina coladas and walks in the rain, and I need the police." I wanted the dispatcher to know the urgency of what was happening outside my front door. But anyway, Alec didn't say anything about his wife and son needing help. He pretty much said that he needed help. He didn't stay close to his wife or son either. He didn't ask how to give CPR or how to help them. He then told the operator, when asked if they were in a vehicle, he said that no, they were out by my kennels. Again, pretty self-centered. I think most people would have said they're out by the kennels. But Alec obviously isn't most people. He's Alec Murdoch. And it was during this call, when asked if he heard anything or if he came home and just found them, he said that he had been gone, he had just come back, and again, this goes against his initial statement of saying that they were just shot. We also know that Alec said that he did touch both Maggie and Paul to check for signs of life. After 7 minutes on the phone, Alec told the dispatcher that he needed to call some of his other family members. Over the next 10 minutes, Alec took close to 700 steps. He took his vehicle out of park, he drove back to the main house and put it back into park. He then took his vehicle back out of park, drove back down to the kennels, getting back to it by 10:14 p.m. This was about 8 minutes after the 911 call. We know that Alec went back to the house to get a gun, in case the killer was still on the property, ostensibly. But this touching of Paul and Maggie and this getting of the gun is believed to be attempts by Alec to make sure that there are reasons why he would have blood, tissue, or gun residue on him. 3 minutes later, Alec called his brother, Randy Murdoch. The connection lasted 16 seconds, and this call was also deleted from his log. A minute later, he sent Randy a text that said, "Please call me, emergency." A minute later, he tried calling again. That connection lasted 1 second and was deleted from his log. 12 seconds later, Alec called his other brother, Don Marvin. This call lasted 40 seconds, also deleted from his call log. The very next call that Alec made was to Rogan Gibson at 10:21 p.m. It would be another 4 minutes before the first of the sheriff's deputies would arrive at the scene. Rogan did not pick up the phone. Later, he would testify in court that he had already gone to bed. 32 seconds later, Alec made a phone call to his sister-in-law, Christy Murdoch. This call lasted 53 seconds. 3 minutes later, at 10:21 p.m., Alec sent a text to Rogan that said, "Call me." 4 minutes later, he tried to FaceTime Rogan, but still received no answer. Alec calling his siblings and sibling-in-laws makes sense. He's anxious. He's waiting for first responders. But why is he calling Rogan? Alec would claim that Rogan was his son's best friend. And they may very well have been good friends, but first off, Rogan wasn't Paul's best friend. And it seemed like to me he was more Buster's friend than Paul's. And secondly, why in the world would Alec be calling Rogan to begin with? Well, the actual reason all really depended on what's going on in Alec's tiny little mind and what he thought Rogan may or may not know regarding what was going on around the dog kennels just before Alec shot Paul and Maggie. It's hard to say what Alec thought or knew, but he obviously was concerned enough to try and get a hold of Rogan just to make sure that he knew what Rogan would say when he would inevitably be questioned in the aftermath of the murders. Alec must have known that Rogan was the last person to interact with Paul before he killed him. So, is it possible that Rogan heard Alec's voice in the background? Did Paul say something about his dad and mom being out there by the kennels too? Alec needed to know so he could maintain control of the narrative. That's why he was desperate to get a hold of Rogan. Because, I mean, come on. Imagine you came home to find one of your adult children shot to death. Would one of the first people you would call be their friends? No, nobody does that. We don't know what Alec knew, but he knew Rogan had been waiting to hear from Paul. So this would leave us asking, what did Alec try to do to Paul's phone? We know that Alec tossed Maggie's phone out of the car window as he was making his alibi drive. But what about Paul's phone? Well, there's only so much you can do when it comes to anyone's iPhone. Paul's phone was locked, and it needed to be unlocked using facial recognition, right? But oh darn, Alec blew Paul's face off. So it's not like Alec could have tried to hold the phone up to Paul's face to attempt to unlock it. I can't even say for sure Alec would have even thought of that in the moment, but I mean, I did. I've wondered if anyone has held a phone up to a dead person's face, if it would unlock. I do know that the eyes would have to be open, and this whole conversation is just really wrong, isn't it? I mean, not as wrong as Alec Murdoch's whole existence was and is, but I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you I wondered about the ability of a dead face to unlock the phone. Anyway, we can infer that Alex noticed or saw that Paul was getting notifications from Rogan on his phone. He may have been able to see what the notification said without unlocking the phone and realized that Rogan was interacting with Paul at a time that was in very close proximity to the moment Paul and Maggie were shot to death. So it became necessary for Alec to get in touch with Rogan in order to maintain control of what was going to be said and what was not going to be said to authorities when they would eventually reach out to Rogan, since he was the last person to speak to Paul on the phone. But Alec couldn't get into Paul's phone, and he couldn't get a hold of Rogan. He later would admit to picking up Paul's phone because I believe it was wiped completely clean, and then he set it down on top of Paul's dead body. So just keep that in mind, everybody. When you do too much murder planning in advance, remember, you can't control what goes on the other end of your victim's phone. We talk and text constantly about where we're at and what we're doing and where we're going. Our phones track us. Some of us have cars that track us. You just can't do anything anymore without everyone and everything knowing what you're up to. And those are the things you just can't control and you can't anticipate when you're trying to plan the perfect murder. So getting back to the cell phone activity and the timeline, Alec attempted to make a FaceTime call to Rogan at 10:25 p.m. It was about that same time that the first responders were arriving at the scene. At 10:29, 4 minutes after the sheriff's deputies arrived, Alec called his brother Randy again. This call lasted 42 seconds. 1 minute later, at 10:30, Alec attempted to FaceTime Rogan yet again, but still received no answer. 4 minutes later, Paul's phone received a call from Nolan Tootin, which I believe is also one of Buster's friends, but it seemed like they had crossover friends. But because Paul's phone was on low battery, it finally died. 1 minute after that, at 10:35 p.m., Alec called his brother, John Marvin, again. This call lasted 28 seconds. A minute after that, Alec made a 56-second call to his brother, Randy. Then, at 10:40 p.m., Alec seemingly made a random search on his phone, Safari browser, for Whaley's Edisto, which is a restaurant established in 1948, making it one of the oldest in the same city where the Murdochs' main place of residence was located. The place even had an option on the menu called Maggie's Favorite Burger, but there really hasn't been any confirmation that this is named specifically after Maggie Murdoch. The search happened 15 minutes after the arrival of the sheriff, and in the midst of all this chaos and violence that had happened at this crime scene. So it had people wondering, why in the world is Alec searching this restaurant at this moment? But I agree with the defense attorney that this was just an accidental thing that happened while Alec was attempting to handle his phone. I seriously doubt that he's trying to look up the soup of the day while he's in the middle of this "I just got back home and found them dead" performance. At 10:44 p.m., Alec called his son Buster, and this connection only lasted 8 seconds. 40 seconds later, Alec called Buster's girlfriend Brooklyn, and that connection lasted 13 seconds, and this call was deleted from Alec's log. Within the same minute, Alec tried calling Tracy White. I'm not 100% sure who this is, but I've assumed that it's Brooklyn's mom. This connection lasted 14 seconds and was also deleted from his log. At 10:46, Buster called his mom's phone but received no answer. A minute later, Alec sent a group text to Buster, Brooklyn, and Tracy that said, "Call me urgent." Within that same minute, Buster called his dad. This call lasted 2 minutes and 42 seconds. At 10:55 p.m., Alec called Brian White again. Not sure who this is, but I assume that this person is also related to Brooklyn, possibly her dad. This connection lasted 14 seconds. And then for the next 21 minutes, there was no activity on Alec's phone. The next person Alec attempted to call was Bart Proctor. This would be Maggie's sister's husband, Maggie's brother-in-law. This connection lasted 14 seconds, and this was at 11:17 p.m. By then, Alec's brother had arrived at the scene, and text messages were coming in from people who were receiving the news of what happened to Paul and Maggie. At 11:47 p.m., the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division arrived at the Moselle property. They are known as SLED for short. It would be on this night, the night that Alec's son and wife were murdered, that he would begin to push the narrative that these killings were a result of death threats that he said Paul had been receiving related to the boat crash from more than 2 years earlier. Alec started the rumor, and some of the media, Nancy Grace being the loudest, began to run with this theory, that this was an act of revenge because of what happened to Mallory Beach. Those who were on the boat that night who survived were each asked to account for their whereabouts the night that Paul and Maggie were shot to death. All of them had alibis that law enforcement were able to confirm, but even so, this theory continued to live on, and it was going to become a part of Alec's defense eventually, that someone else killed Maggie and Paul, not him, that this had something to do with the boat crash, and it was a revenge killing of sorts. Alec made it clear that night that the shootings happened that he was confident that these two events, the boat crash and the shootings, were related. He would even testify to this when he took the stand during his murder trial, that these shootings came after months and months of threats against Paul. Alec Murdoch didn't actually fall under suspicion for the murders of Paul and Maggie right away. But the one thing that Alec did have going for him, which has been speculated to be the reason why Paul and Maggie were killed, is that the investigation his law firm was launching into his misappropriation of firm, client, and government monies was put on hold indefinitely, if not forgotten altogether. It was even stated as such on the stand by the accountant. They weren't going to go after this financial indiscretions of Alec's, in the wake of him losing his wife and son. They may have just quietly allowed Murdoch to resign voluntarily, using Maggie and Paul's death as the reason for him needing to step away, and Alec could have very well rode off quietly into the sunset while working on molding Buster into becoming the next shining star of the Murdoch dynasty. But that's not what would happen. 3 days after Maggie and Paul were murdered, Alec's dad, Randolph III, died at the age of 81 after a variety of health issues. And while Randolph III's death really had nothing to do with anything that was going on at the time, it did serve to add interest into this case. But perhaps Randolph III did have an indirect role in everything that would end up happening. Let's explore that. While Alec's dad wasn't really a major player in everything his wayward son was finding himself mired in, it really isn't a stretch to believe that Randolph III probably enabled much of Alec's behavior, likely for his entire life. Just as Alec, and I'd even go so far as to say Randolph too, did the same for Paul. And this was evident in the fact that Randolph III was the one Paul called first the morning of the boat crash. He didn't call his dad, he called his grandpa. Even Paul knew his dad wasn't the man. It was Randolph III who still wielded all the power. He was the last of the Murdochs to hold the office of solicitor, and he did so for 20 years until he went into private practice. And for whatever reason, none of his children went on to vie for the office. And like I said in part one, Alec maintained his connection to the solicitor's office by volunteering, I believe for the sole purpose of getting that stupid badge. But aside from that, I will never believe that Alec volunteered at the solicitor's office out of the goodness of his heart, purely based on the fact that this guy was stealing millions of dollars across at least a decade that we know of. There is some reason why Alec didn't run for solicitor, and I'd bet that it had everything to do with the fact that if he were to run for office, his personal and professional life would have come under scrutiny. And later on, we're going to talk about Alec as an attorney, and the accountant at the law firm said some very unflattering things about Alec and whether or not he was an effective attorney. But anyway, I mean, let's get real about this. Let's consider the time frame and the year that Alec's father retired. And running for office at that time, it would have been the first time that a Murdoch trying to get elected to that position would have had to face being put under the microscope of social media. And if I had to hazard a guess, I'd say none of them, Alec or his siblings, really wanted to go there. There is no doubt that the Murdochs came from money. Every generation of them had wealth and storied careers. So when Alec found himself in the mess that he found himself in because of Paul's boat crash, I believe that the guy had options. Paul was going to go to jail. At least he should have anyway. In the 2 months following the crash, it seemed like nothing was going to happen. Paul hadn't been arrested. There were no charges. So because of that, Mallory's family filed a wrongful death suit in order for Alec's finances to be subject to subpoena. If they weren't going to get justice in the criminal courts, they would hit them in the finances. Alec was looking to have all his mess put on full display for the world to see, and he was going to be exposed for all of those financial misappropriations. And the one case that was going to stand out above all was the one that was the most suspicious, and it involved a suspicious death, that of Gloria Satterfield. It was almost a year before Paul crashed the boat. Gloria fell on February 2nd, 2018, and she died 24 days later on February 26th. Paul would crash that boat 1 year minus 2 days later on February 24th, 2019. The $4.3 million that Alec gained from Gloria's death had to have been one of the largest amounts that he took from a single client, considering he's currently being accused of stealing somewhere around $9 million over the course of at least 10 years. We don't know if Alec had a hand in Gloria's fall necessarily, but we do know that it was awfully convenient that her death was never reported to the county coroner, no autopsy was performed initially, and her death was ruled natural causes, and Alec profited handsomely. Circumstantially, it is not a good look for Alec. So what the heck was going on here? Well, I believe in the first part I talked about Alec's history with financial hard times and what likely happened when he was hit with the recession in 2008 and then COVID in 2020. Alec obviously was not making any money volunteering at the solicitor's office. His currency was from that badge that he got from there and the power and the clout that came along with it. But that's only going to get him so far for so long. Or should I say, get you out of things for so long. It's not going to put money into your pockets. So Alec was having to earn money the way the rest of us do, by working. And he pretty much had a law partnership waiting for him at the family firm from the day that he was born. But sometimes when someone is raised in this sort of bubble of prominence, privilege, and prestige, it can give a person this sense of entitlement. And when things come to a person too easily, there's this lack of appreciation for hard work. And I by no means want to take away from the work that it took Alec to become an attorney in the first place. And that's if he did everything legitimately and on the up and up, meaning that he didn't cheat or cut any corners making his way through law school. But I don't even want to try to get into that right now. But there is no doubt that a great deal of work goes into being a practicing attorney. It's a lot of work, and sometimes it can be all-consuming. We talk about criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors all the time in true crime, and so we know that it's daunting. Alec was a civil attorney, and that still takes a great deal of work, knowledge, and know-how to be successful at it. And to be honest, it doesn't look like it can get much easier than the situation Alec was handed when he went on to carry the family legacy within the firm. It was a job ready-made and tailor-made for the Murdochs before him and the Murdochs to come. Maybe. I don't know anymore. I don't know if Buster will ever be able to make his way into the firm. I do know the name is no longer a part of the firm. But despite that, Alec would still have to put in some work. And he's in this type of law. He's that kind of attorney that gives attorneys that reputation of being ambulance chasers, right? I don't know what it's like in other big cities, but here in Las Vegas, There are personal injury attorney billboards all over the place. And it's not just my imagination. I went on Google and it said so. It's true. There are lots of personal injury attorneys in Vegas. There are ads all over the city, all over buses and television. And it's just the nature of Vegas being a 24-hour kind of a town. And lots of crap happens around the clock, and Nevada is a fault state. What does that mean? Well, the example I found on the top sponsored result when I Googled is that when someone gets into, for example, a car accident in Nevada, the injured party retains the right to sue the negligent driver who caused the accident for compensation. Another reason, according to the injured attorney's website that I was on, his name was Brian Boyer, that personal injury lawyers flooded the state of Nevada. In a no-fault state, you are responsible for collecting compensation from your own insurance company. So if you hired a car accident attorney, you would essentially be suing yourself. In a fault state, injury victims receive compensation for medical bills, pain and suffering, lost wages, etc., etc. Most of the time, that compensation is collected directly from the negligent driver's insurance company. Lawyers throughout the United States have caught wind of this situation here in Nevada and have actually relocated to Las Vegas to attempt to capitalize on its demanding market and fault laws. Lawyers usually expand their practice to include personal injury and so on and so forth. So, like I said, ambulance chasers. That's the reputation, and this is the sort of work that Alec was into. And these were the victims that Alec bilked money from and took advantage of. But why though? Attorneys have that reputation, but you know, for the most part, they do legitimate work. If someone is injured, they deserve to be compensated, and attorneys have the expertise to achieve the best outcome for their clients. And it kind of sounded like the Murdochs had a stronghold on the Lowcountry when it came to this aspect of the law and the criminal justice system in the area too. It was pretty much a win-win if you happen to be a Murdoch with a law license. So, why was Alec Murdoch such a freaking loser? He says it was a long-standing debilitating addiction to opioids, to the tune of upwards of $50,000 a week, according to some reports. That's $2.6 million a year. Yeah, I did math. If all the money that Alec took from his law firm and from Gloria Satterfield's wrongful death settlement is really gone, then a $2.6 million a year habit would make some sense. And that's if all the money went to drugs. Alec had a very high-end lifestyle. He had properties, vehicles, vacations. I mean, Maggie was getting a foot massage while her housekeeper left a hot, home-cooked meal on the stove for the family to have that evening at their more than 1,700-acre sprawling family riverfront estate, complete with a custom-built home, a farm, some dog kennels, and amenities for outdoor activities, including hunting, fishing, and kayaking. And absolutely no hate on Maggie for living the life. It's just not for me. I'm way too ticklish for a foot massage, and bottom line is I love cooking for my family and my loved ones. I do have my own guilty little pleasures, but I by no means am putting anybody down for their pleasures in life. My point is that there is a certain lifestyle that they have going on here, the Murdochs, and it takes a lot of upkeep, which takes a lot of money. And if Alec was truly battling a serious opioid addiction, I doubt it was to the tune of $50,000 a week, but I absolutely believe that it rendered him incapable of working at the capacity that he needed to in order to be an effective attorney and bring in the kinds of money that he needed to in order to support his lifestyle. And as you get older, it only gets harder and harder as addiction and age begins to take its toll on your body across many years. Prior to all of his legal problems, Alec definitely looked like a very jolly, spoiled little man. And I don't know why I think that. It's just his look, you know. Slap a beard and a red suit on the guy and he'd make a great mall Santa. But anyway, my point is, Alec wasn't bringing in the kinds of money that he needed to keep up the lifestyle and the lifestyle of his family. If he was as addicted to drugs as he claimed to be, then you know his mind and his body were probably turned to mush, and the fastest, easiest way to keep the money flowing in was to cook some books and create some funny business with the finances at the firm. And even that wouldn't be enough, because you can only go so far with that before the law firm starts to notice that something hinky is going on. Alec managed to carry on with his little scheme for a while. But really, when it comes to stuff like this, we've seen it time and time again. The best and easiest and most lucrative way to get a large chunk of money is for somebody else to die. Time and time again. And the more irrelevant, quote unquote irrelevant, the person is, the better. And that isn't a stretch for Murdoch, because to them, most other people are irrelevant. And that is not to say that Gloria Satterfield fell into this category. She was absolutely a relevant person, but in the eyes of Alec, she probably wasn't. We don't know what, if anything, Alec had to do with Gloria's death. We don't know all the details right now. They're looking into it. But like I said, all the circumstances surrounding it, it just all looks bad. Because now we are talking about a man who was found to have been capable of murdering his own son and wife in cold blood, which makes him absolutely capable of doing away with his housekeeper. And you know, if he did it, he probably thought about it for quite some time. I mean, do we really think that the day Paul and Maggie were murdered just happened to fall on the same day that Alec was confronted about the missing monies at the law firm? And 3 days before the hearing on the boat accident that was going to have Alec be compelled to make the details of his finances public? And did he really come up with this murder, this double murder plan on the fly? It may have all come together on that day, but this guy had to have been thinking about this for a while. Alec had 2 long years to sit around and ponder that boat that Paul crashed and how that was going to sink him. And it's probably not beyond the realm of possibility that Alec spent those 2 years weighing his options. And those would be the options that would cost Alec as little as possible. And the options could have involved tapping his dad for a bailout. We don't know what Randolph III knew about all that Alec had done. We don't know if he would have been willing to help Alec out of the mess that he'd found himself in. I can imagine it would be a hard thing for a son to have to admit to his father all the terrible things that Alec had done. But we know to an extent that there is a side of Randolph III that would have very much shown up in the face of a crisis. Remember, when Paul crashed the boat, he called Randolph. At the time, the man was, 78 or 79 years old? Yet he was still willing to get up in the wee hours of the morning to clean up his grandson's mess. Now, my dad was 50 years old when I was born, and before he would even let me get behind the wheel of a car, I had to prove to my dad that I knew how to change a flat tire all by myself, because he didn't want my ass calling him in the middle of the night with my problems, because my dad was old. Randolph III was old, but he still got up, got dressed, and went over to the hospital to go save his grandson. And there's nothing to say that he wouldn't have done the same for his son. Paul was looking at losing his freedom. Grandpa could have had a say in what happened or didn't happen, and to what extent, in terms of Paul's criminal case. But Alec, his problems were going to amount to millions and millions of dollars, and it could have been more than Randolph III was willing to pay to bail Alec out. Paul wasn't beyond redemption, but perhaps, in Randolph III's eyes, Alec was. Alec could have spent those 2 years between the boat crash and the double murders thinking about how he could weasel his way out of this. I wouldn't have put it past him to try and get his parents' wealth, get his hands on their money somehow. He could have asked for help, but Alec is hardly their only heir, and considering that he was the black sheep of the family, that was a conversation that probably wasn't going to go well for him. Randolph III had children and grandchildren galore. Would he have really sunk $10 million into Alec's mountain of legal problems? And even if he did, there wouldn't have been any kind of guarantee that that would have kept Alec out of prison. which is what Alec wanted to avoid. And then Randolph III's health began to seriously fail. I don't know if Alec realized just how close his father was to death the day he murdered Paul and Maggie, but you know, he probably knew it wasn't looking good. Buster said on the stand that they heard it was terminal. And if and when Randolph III were to pass away, then everything would be left to his mother, Libby Murdoch, who at the time was in the late stages of dementia, which she still is. And the most recent reports are that she's on her deathbed. So the chances of Alec getting any financial help or the kinds of help that he was going to need to get out of his mounting legal and financial problems, it was growing less and less likely if he was considering tapping his parents. Alec spent those two intervening years stalling, but what he was stalling was the inevitable. The Murdochs, by way of his son and his actions, were finally going to be held accountable. And because of that, Alec was going to be held accountable for what he was doing and all the underhanded things he had been involved in. Like I said, I don't know how much or how little Randolph III was going to be able and willing to help Alec out, but on June the 7th, 2021, with his death and the court hearing for the boat crash swirling around him, it just kind of felt like Alec got desperate to make it all stop, and his solution was to just try and buy himself more time. And the cost of that time? It was Paul and Maggie's lives. But that was only going to work for him for so long by then. The walls had already started closing in, and their murders may have stalled it, but it wasn't going to make it stop. Alec was able to get rid of his son and wife, but he wasn't going to be able to get rid of the Beach family, or the Satterfield family, and all the other countless families that he harmed through the years. They were still going to come for him. And once the initial shock of the murders of Paul and Maggie wore off, that smokescreen that Alec managed to put up around himself, it began to dissipate once again, and everyone was beginning to clearly see exactly the kind of man that they were dealing with in Alec Murdoch. After Paul, Maggie, and Randolph III died, Alec would spend the next 3 months doing whatever it was that Alec did. But what he did next would end up changing the course of pretty much everything. On September 4th, 2021, Alec was involved and injured in some sort of convoluted roadside shooting slash setup slash suicide slash whatever. It was some sort of attempt that left Alec with a superficial head wound. And you know, it is such a stupid thing to have happened, and there are so many stories and theories regarding what that whole thing was about. Alec first said it was an attempt on his life as he was changing or inspecting a flat tire out on some rural roadside. And just at that moment, some rando person just happened by and sort of shot him in the head. Later, Alec said it was a suicide attempt in order for it to look like a homicide, so his remaining son, Buster, would be able to benefit from the life insurance. Alec apparently asked his distant cousin, Curtis, Cousin Eddie Edward Smith, to be in on this mess, but Cousin Eddie has since put forth a theory that this was some sort of wacky plan for Alec to murder him in order for Cousin Eddie to take the fall for the murders of Paul and Maggie. And when Eddie realized why Alec had lured him out to that roadside, it became obvious that this plot of Alec's now involved his death. A fight over the gun ensued, and Alec ended up with a graze wound to the head. Cousin Eddie said that he was afraid that Alec was dead, so he fled the scene. However, this is the newest version of Cousin Eddie's story, and it contradicts his own statements that he made a little more than a month after the roadside shooting on the Today Show. On the show, Cousin Eddie said, contrary to what Alec was saying at the time, he was not a willing participant in this alleged assisted suicide plot, asserting that when he arrived at the scene, Alec was the one who had the gun, and it appeared that he was going to shoot himself. And when Cousin Eddie tried to intervene to prevent Alec from doing so, The gun went off, causing the graze wound on his head. When he saw that Alec wasn't seriously injured, he left, leaving Alec to call 911 to make up the whole story about getting a flat tire and someone randomly shooting him. And this newest version that Cousin Eddie now claims what happened, that this was an attempt at a frame job to pin Paul and Maggie's murders on him, it kinda sounds about plausible. But Cousin Eddie has had a year and a half to come up with this new version of the story, a story that he could have told back when all of this went down and potentially saved himself a lot of grief. But you know, he'll have his reasons for that too, most likely that he was afraid or intimidated by Alec and didn't want to reveal the truth. All of that has yet to unfold at this point. As far as I know, Cousin Eddie is still on the hook right now for charges involving conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. And I mean, even if the initial version that Alec told was the truth, that this was a plot for Buster to collect on his life insurance policy, but his death had to look like a homicide, that still puts Cousin Eddie in a lot of legal trouble because whatever the reason, you just can't go around shooting or planning on shooting somebody. That version of the story, of course, paints Alec in the best light possible, making him out to be some sort of hero, sacrificing his life for the betterment of Buster, the only one left who could possibly rebuild the Murdoch family legacy. But I find that to be a pile of poop because Alec Murdoch isn't that benevolent or self-sacrificing. I'd sooner believe that he was trying to set Eddie up for the double murders over Alec's willingness to take one for the team. So after this roadside shooting, Alec was flown with this little wound of his to a hospital in the next state over in Savannah, Georgia. But from what it sounded like, it was a thing that did not even require an airlift, but whatever. All of this was, to many of us with our eyes and ears tuned into this case at that point, was yet another attempt by Alec to detract from the issues at hand, that he was a scoundrel and that he was a murderer. The very next day, Alec resigned from his law firm, which seemed like an unnecessary move considering he was about to get fired and charged with 99 crimes. But all this did was cause everybody to take an even closer look past the veneer of him being a Murdoch and begin to wonder what he probably had to do with Maggie and Paul's murder. After Alec was discharged from the hospital with his little head wound, he then checked himself into rehab in Florida. It was all inevitable, and I'll never understand why this guy couldn't just own what he did. Why he had to take his son and his wife out with him. It just doesn't make any sense, at least to the rest of us. But if Alec had been scrambling his brains with copious amounts of drugs through the years, then this man wasn't thinking clearly, with the exception of the fact that he wanted anything and everyone else to go down in flames before he would go down. Well, a few hours after Alec announced this resignation, the law firm set the record straight by releasing its own statement to the press with the allegations that Murdoch had misappropriated company funds. 2 days later, on September 8, 2021, Alec's license to practice law was indefinitely suspended by the South Carolina Supreme Court. A little more than a week after the roadside shooting, authorities investigating the incident allege that Alec had arranged for the whole thing in order for Buster to collect on a $10 million life insurance policy. They announced that they had arrested and charged Cousin Eddie with assisted suicide, assault and battery of a highly aggravated nature, pointing and presenting a firearm, insurance fraud, and conspiracy to commit insurance fraud. The next day, Alec's attorney, Dick Harpootlian, went on the Today Show and announced that Alec was depressed. So yeah, Alec, join the club. Also, that Alec was working through his addiction. Again, join the club. Harpootlian also said that Alec believed there to be a suicide clause in his insurance policy, meaning that if Alec took his own life, then his life insurance wouldn't pay out, and that he enlisted the help of Cousin Eddie to shoot him during a staged car breakdown. Now, I found it interesting that Harputlian said Alec believed there to be a suicide clause. What that insinuates is that there actually wasn't a suicide clause, which there was in fact not. And you know, Alec is a man who is all about money, and there is no way that I will believe that this guy did not know that there either wasn't a suicide clause, or that whatever time needed to pass between the insurance policy being purchased and the time the insured's death had happened had already expired, so that suicide clause would no longer be in effect. There is no way. With $10 million on the line, there's no way that I believe that Alec didn't know about it. I absolutely believe that he could have taken his own life and the beneficiary would get the money. He was too smart and too dialed in to not know. So that leads me to believe that there is some validity to the notion that this wasn't a botched assisted suicide attempt, but rather an attempt at making Cousin Eddie the fall guy for Paul and Maggie's murders. Just like Alec tried to make Connor Cook the fall guy for crashing the boat, resulting in Mallory's death. This is exactly what Alec Murdoch does. I just don't understand why Cousin Eddie wouldn't just say that in the first place. Maybe he didn't want to get Alec in trouble. Perhaps he was intimidated by him. I don't know. It was about the same time that this mess was going on that South Carolina state authorities were opening up a criminal investigation into Gloria Satterfield's death. I mean, it's like 3 years and $4.3 million too late, but better late than never, I guess. The day after that, on September 16th, Alec turned himself in to answer to the insurance fraud charges, along with conspiracy and filing a false police report related to this roadside shooting. Alec was subsequently released on bail, his passport was confiscated, and he was allowed to go back to the rehab center that he had checked himself in after that roadside shooting, not shooting. A month later, when Alec was released from rehab in Florida, he was arrested, this time on charges of obtaining property by false pretenses related to the death of Gloria Satterfield, specifically the $4.3 million that he pocketed from the wrongful death lawsuit that he filed against himself. 3 days after he was taken into custody, Alec was denied bond, and the court ordered him to have a psychiatric evaluation completed. For the remainder of 2021, Alec was hit with dozens of charges related to his shady dealings at the law firm, including breach of trust with fraudulent intent, obtaining signature or property by false pretenses, money laundering, computer crimes, and forgery. On December 13th, Alec's bond was set at $7 million, which he would be unable to make. January of 2022 rolled around and the charges kept on a-coming. More fraud, more breach of trust, more computer crimes, etc., etc. Then a legal claim was filed against the estates of Maggie and Paul by Mallory Beach's family, along with two other survivors of the boat crash, among other lawsuits that had been filed all related to that boat crash. In March of 2022, more fraud charges were brought against Alec, but this time his friend and co-conspirator Corey Fleming was also charged. More charges were piled on both disgraced attorneys in May of 2022, and then in June of 2022, it was announced that the family of Gloria Satterfield gave the okay for authorities to exhume her body as a part of the investigation into her death, related to the question swirling around her official manner of death being ruled as natural, which is inconsistent with injuries that would have been sustained from a fall down the stairs in this type of quote-unquote accident. And then later on in June of 2022, Cousin Eddie found himself in even more trouble when he was taken into custody on new charges. Some of the same old, money laundering, forgery, conspiracy, blah, blah, blah. Then just 4 days after that, both Cousin Eddie and Alec were indicted by a grand jury on a slew of criminal conspiracy and narcotics charges, both accused of conspiring to buy and distribute oxycodone from 2013 to 2021. Cousin Eddie has been described as Alec's drug supplier. And, you know, they say when it rains, it pours. On July 14th, 2022, Alec Murdoch was indicted for the murders of his wife and son. 6 days later, Alec pleaded not guilty to the charges and would subsequently ask for a speedy trial so he could just get this little matter out of the way and start looking for the true killers. Yeah, I wonder how that's going for him. A month after that, Alec was hit with more money laundering and computer crime charges. In October of 2022, Alec's murder trial was set to begin on January 23rd, 2023. It was expected to last 3 weeks, but it ended up taking 6 weeks. On December 9th, 2022, during a pre-trial hearing, the prosecution in Alec's double murder case put forth a theory for the first time that Alec killed his wife and son in order to cast himself as a sympathetic figure while at the same time getting himself out of being held accountable for the financial crimes that he was being accused of. Alec's attorneys argued that this was a ridiculous motive. Why would Alec try to get himself out of a financial criminal investigation only to put himself in the middle of a murder investigation? Well, the answer to that is quite simple. Alec figured that the only way he was going to see himself out of the financial crimes investigation was for something drastic to happen, and he planned on getting away with the double murders. He didn't expect to get caught up in the middle of a murder investigation, as his attorney had stated, and Alec probably figured that there was no way that anyone would believe that the loving father and husband would do something like that, and he would be able to ride his family clout and his family name out of any kind of trouble. To an extent, Alec was right. It was really hard to believe that a man would do something like that to the people that he supposedly loved the most in this world. Unfortunately for Paul and Maggie, and for Buster as well, Alec loved himself way more than any of them. And to be honest, Buster is lucky to be alive, because I have no doubt that if it served his purposes, Alec would see him dead too. For the second half of December of 2022, Alec had some good news and some bad news. The bad news was that he was getting slapped with more indictments for his financial crimes, bringing the total somewhere around 100 charges. The good news was that the prosecutors announced that they would not be seeking the death penalty against him in the double murder case. They decided that it would save everyone the time and money and grief in the long run, and they were just content to see this guy behind bars for the rest of his life. So the trial began as expected on January 23rd. And you know, he's got to get this out of the way in order to go searching for the real killer, right? And so the first week or so of the trial was pretty much as expected. Jury selection, opening statements, what Alec allegedly did, that he shot Paul with a shotgun, and then he went after Maggie with a second gun, which was an AR type of rifle, shooting both of them at close range, ending both of them with gunshots to the head that left a pretty bloody and gruesome crime scene behind. But then things got a little interesting in February when the prosecution played a video that none of us had seen, heard, or even knew existed before. And it was quite some time before anybody was able to get to it, because Paul's phone had been locked, and it would turn out to be one of the game changers as far as Alec and his defense was concerned. And that would be that video that Paul took just minutes before he was shot to death. It was meant to be a video of the injured tail on the dog that belonged to Rogan Gibson, so that he and his veterinarian friend could assess. But that video was never sent, because it's kind of hard to text a video from your cell phone when your dad blows you away with a shotgun. That video was taken about 4 to 5 minutes before it was believed that Paul was gunned down by his father, and on it, Alec's very distinctive voice can be heard along with Maggie's. There was no getting around it, and what that video managed to do was blow Alec's alibi that he was ever down by the kennels the night of the murders completely out of the water, along with his claims that he did not see either one of them for about an hour or so before they were killed. Alec claimed that he was asleep on the sofa, and then suddenly he had this urge after 9 p.m. to go visit his mom, who suffers from dementia, and was asleep during the whole time that he was making this alibi. Logic dictates that there would be no reason for someone to lie about not being at the scene of a crime unless they were there committing the crime. It was very unlikely that a random killer would have gone out there onto the family property within that hour that Alec initially claimed that he was in the house asleep on the sofa, and they happened upon Paul and Maggie, and they happened upon two guns that belonged to the Murdochs, and happened to murder both of them with multiple gunshots in that very slim window of time where Alec was asleep. And he didn't even hear the shotgun blast or the five shots that were fired from the AR-style rifle. Didn't hear any of it. And then just randomly got up and decided to go to his mom's house when the whole day they'd all been talking about how sick his dad was. Mom had dementia and would likely have not even been aware of what was going on with Randolph III, at least not that night. And when you cut that scenario down to 5 minutes, the 5 minutes between Paul's video capturing Alec's voice and the shootings, it's impossible for Alec to have not been at the kennels and to have heard and seen everything that went down. And that's because it was him. He was the one who raised those two guns, one at his son and one at his wife, and he murdered them both. Everything else Alec did that night was captured on his cell phone and on his OnStar. Alec was smart enough to leave his phone alone in the house while he went out and did the actual murder, but as soon as he picked it back up and started to build his alibi, all it did was serve the purpose of supporting the theories put forth by the prosecution. His phone began tracking his location, how many steps he was taking, and the pace at which he was taking them. He began texting and calling people, driving faster than he normally would have drove as he headed towards his mom's house. And when he got there, he parked a distance away, halfway up the driveway. One of the odd things that Alec did, and I don't think he had any good explanation for, were the calls that he made to Rogan. He figured at some point, possibly when he was looking at Paul's phone, and I believe Alec picked up Paul's phone before he started creating the alibi and saw that Rogan had been calling, and he couldn't have possibly explained that he picked up Paul's phone before he went to his mom's house to go visit her, so he made up the whole story about Paul's phone falling out of his pocket when he got back and tried to move his body. But anyway, after he killed Paul, he realized that in the moments leading up to Paul's death, that he and Rogan were messaging each other. And it was in such close proximity to the time that Paul was murdered. And Rogan was there waiting for a response from Paul and waiting for a video of his dog's tail. I think Alec saw the phone before he left the property, before he started to establish his alibi, and realized that Rogan may have been an ear witness to what had happened and tried calling him, but he had already gone to sleep. In the end, it wouldn't matter because Paul and his cell phone video provided the irrefutable proof that Alec was at the dog kennels just minutes before the shootings, undermining Alec's story the night of the murders that he was never at the kennels, that he was asleep in the main house, and then he just left to go visit his mom. February 23rd, 2023 marked the fifth week of Alec's murder trial, and that was the week that he took the stand in his own defense, where, of course, he would adamantly deny shooting his wife and son. I have to admit that I didn't watch very much of the trial as it was happening, and the parts that I did watch after the fact, I watched clips. I just really didn't have the time to invest like I would have wanted to. But the parts that I did see of Alec's testimony didn't really impress me one way or another. I've seen photos of Alec on the stand with tears and I guess some mucus dripping from his nose. So when I heard the jurors say that there weren't any tears, there were tears, but you can still be disingenuous and emotional at the same time. It would not surprise me at all if it was really traumatic and emotional for Alec to have witnessed the dead bodies of his wife and son the way that he did, even though he was the one that made them that way. It's one thing to conceptualize murdering someone in your head, and I would imagine that it's quite another to actually go through with it and to see what's supposed to be on the inside of one's skull blown apart to the outside. I'm not surprised at all that the images and the discussion of it all would bring the man to tears. I also don't put it past Alec to also be shedding tears for himself. He's on trial for his life. This was his one chance to strip everything away. The family name, the social status, being a part of the upper echelon, his position as an attorney, and for him to show the world that he was a loving and grieving husband, father, and family man who could never, would never do such a thing as he was being accused. Alec described the moment that he discovered Maggie and Paul's body, and I'll let you hear it from the man himself.
And Alec, did you drive down to the kennels in your Suburban?
I did.
And what'd you see?
Saw what y'all have seen pictures of. So bad. Can I have some water? Yeah, I went to,
Did you see them on the ground when you're pulling up in your Suburban?
I did.
And what'd you do when you came to a stop, Alec?
I think I jumped out of my car. I'm not exactly sure what I did, but no, I got out of my car. I know I ran back to my car, called 911. I called 911. I was on the phone with 911, and I was trying to tend to Paul. I was trying to tend to Maggie. And I just went back and forth between them.
Were you going to Paul and Maggie while you were on the phone with the 911 operators?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
In a little bit, I'm going to play the 911 tape, but I just want to ask you, and you've told law enforcement that's been played here in the court, what did you do when you went up to Paul at some point in time?
Hey, Paul. Paul was so, he was so bad. At some point, I know I tried to check him for a pulse. I know I tried to turn him over.
When you say you tried to turn him over, why were you trying to turn him over?
I don't know. I don't know why I tried to turn him over. Me and my boys lay face down. And he's done the way he's done. His head was the way his head was. I could see his brain laying on the sidewalk. I didn't know what to do. I mean, I just Tried to turn him over. Tried to grab him by the belt loop. Tried to turn him over. And when I did, his phone popped out. His phone popped out. And she picked it up and I put it right back there.
Do you have any idea how it popped out?
I mean, I know it came out of his pocket when I pulled on his belt loop. When I pulled him to turn him over. And it just popped out. And I mean, it popped right beside him. It sat right beside him.
Were you able to turn Paul at all?
I mean, I didn't. I don't know if I was able to. I didn't turn him over, no. No. No.
What side of the... on what side of Paul were you when you were doing this?
I was on the side that was away from... I was on the side that was away from where my car was.
Okay.
Yeah.
What'd you do with the phone?
I put it back on Paw.
You know if you put it, you know which way it was pointing, upside down, downside, in any way?
I couldn't tell you anything about it. I know his phone popped out. I picked it up and I put it back on him.
Did you see any messages on Paul's phone?
No.
Did you go to Maggie?
Did.
Did you touch her?
I did.
Where did you touch Maggie?
I think I touched her down just around like, I don't know. If you ask me exactly, I think I touched her down around her waist, but I don't know. It was so bad.
Well, obviously, his attempt at saving himself didn't work. But Alex's emotions on the stand seemed real to me compared to other criminal defendants, but we don't always get to see them testify. We see them in interrogation rooms, we see them in jailhouse phone calls, but not all of them take the stand. In fact, very few do. And I mean, if nothing else, Alec gets maybe a B+ for effort. There are other times that Alec displayed emotion during the trial, and that was during opening statements. Buster was sitting behind him as the prosecution and defense presented their cases. Alec had another breakdown when the body cam video of the scene where Paul and Maggie were killed was shown in the court. Alec also cried when the video clip that Paul took right before he died was played. And all three of their voices, Paul's, Maggie's, and Alex's, can be heard. And there was no denying that was Alex's voice. He didn't even try to deny it. He owned it on the stand. I did watch an interview that three of the jurors did a day or so after the verdict, and they all came in coordinating outfits, which I thought was really cute. And it goes to show, it's a testament to how close people can get on a jury and how much they can bond. And we know that it only took them 3 hours to deliberate the verdict and to find Alec guilty of the murders. But they did say on the Today Show, on Good Morning America, I think it was. I can't remember. Sorry. They did say that not all of them went into the deliberations ready to vote guilty. But to me, seeing as it only took 3 hours, it doesn't look like it took that much convincing. They did seem like they were fair. They followed the rules. They never talked about the case until the deliberations. But in order to make sure that they covered any questions that anyone had that cropped up at any point during the trial, they kept a notebook where they could jot things down so that they would remember to bring them up when it was time to deliberate. The three jurors also said that they didn't buy Alex's emotions, that it didn't seem genuine, and he didn't do himself any favors by getting on the stand. They understood ahead of time that Alex was an attorney, and he had the ability to maneuver emotions and to maneuver emotionally, which I thought was quite an astute assessment of Alex. Because I did watch the testimony of the woman who was the accountant at the law firm that Alex was a partner at, and she made it clear now that she has had this time to reflect back on the weeks and months leading up to Paul and Maggie's murders, she can now see where things began to change with Alex. But prior to that, you know, and I think somewhere along the way in these episodes, I referred to Alex as a good attorney, maybe even earlier in this one, or a skilled attorney. And while this accountant acknowledged that Alex was effective at winning large settlements, it wasn't necessarily as a result of Alex being a technically skilled lawyer, or that he practiced at any kind of cerebral level with this deep understanding of the nuances of civil law. She called him savvy when it came to the art of bullshit. She said he was loud, boisterous, he was good at manipulating, getting people on his side, and achieving the most favorable outcome for himself. Alex used his larger-than-life personality, and it served its purpose in multiple ways, including winning sizable settlements, being able to get things to go in his favor, but also being able to misappropriate funds without being challenged or questioned. It was interesting to listen to this accountant explain just how careful and fearful people were about questioning Alex. But it got to a point where Alex was being so brazen about it that it was going to get the accountant into trouble if she wasn't keeping her books on the up and up, and all of that dependent on Alex being forthcoming with what exactly he was doing, especially as it was getting close to the time of his hearing about that book case. Alex told the accountant on the 7th of June, earlier in the day, the same day that Maggie and Paul were killed, that later on in the week, he was going to have to cough up his finances for an upcoming hearing in the boat crash case. The boat crash had been hanging over Alex's head by then for more than 2 years. And it was on that very same day that the accountant confronted Alex about the fees that he had received on a specific case that he had been working on. She suspected that Alex had paid himself the fees, and the way that it structured at the law firm is that money is paid out from settlements or from trials, and it's supposed to go into the firm's trust account. From there, everything else gets paid out. Any costs that the firm incurred while working on a case, medical bills that are owed on behalf of the client, the attorney's fees, and then whatever is left over goes to the client. Everything gets settled, but all the money has to be funneled through this trust account. Alex, in this one particular case, circumvented the trust account, and the attorney's fees went directly into an annuity account. It's sort of the way an attorney will want to perhaps set aside money for a retirement. Instead of taking their attorney's fees when the settlement is paid, they can put it into a structured account that will pay them out starting at some point in the future in increments, which saves them on taxes. The accountant described it as like a 401k. Alex told her that the money went directly into this structured account, but the way that he did it wasn't the way that they were supposed to do it, because it all had to go through the firm's trust account first, and she needed to account for that money on their books. And on June 7th, the accountant told Alex that she needed him to prove where that money was so she would be able to work it into her books, and they would worry about balancing everything out at the end of the year, as they do every year. The amount was somewhere like $600,000. The accountant knew that Alex was being a little slippery and shifty about it, but at that point, they were still kind of tiptoeing around him because he's a Murdoch. And then Maggie and Paul were murdered. The accountant caught wind of it late that evening, and she and everyone else dropped the matter of all this funny business with the money. If that was Alex's goal, to deflect the scrutiny of the fishy finances by murdering Paul and Maggie, then it worked. but only temporarily. Alec Murdoch made a very devastating permanent decision by murdering his son and his wife to fix what he was hoping would be a temporary problem, a couple of temporary problems, namely the boat crash lawsuits and his embezzlement activities. I don't know how or why this guy thought, even for a moment, that he would be able to make those things go away by making his son and wife go away. And the fact that the accountant basically called Alec a bullshit attorney, it really gets you thinking twice about people like him and how we perceive them. I was watching some clips of Alec's son, Buster Murdoch, and his testimony. And I mean, once you get past how astonishingly red this kid's hair is, that's just about the reddest redhead I've ever seen in my life. Like, it's almost fluorescent red. It's so bright. And after listening to his testimony, it's obvious that these people don't live like the most of us. There are some of you out there who may have had a primary home, a hunting property home, and a beach home growing up. So when those pesky hurricanes hit and topple palm trees onto your house, you have the main house or the hunting house to fall back on. Some of you may have the family boat to drive yourself and your friends around at your leisure, and an entire room inside your beautiful house dedicated to your vast gun collection. And as Buster sat on the stand and talked about all this privilege, I mean, whoever it was that said more money, more problems, was that notorious B.I.G., it wasn't wrong. But look at what money did to this family. Seriously, money enabled them to have all the things, but the money ended up toppling them in spectacular fashion. And look at Alec now. He had it all. Money, homes, vehicles, vacations, status, power, clout, family name. All of this, it really puts things into perspective for us listening. I don't have a single problem with my little apartment and my three little dogs driving around in my little Hyundai, doing my little job and my little podcast. And I'm sitting here on my laptop typing this. A little while ago, I decided to light a candle. And it's been right here in front of me. It smells like vanilla. I felt a little bit privileged and spoiled the other day when I made an order at Target for this candle and some dog food, some ice cream bars, and some jelly beans. And my lazy ass chose the drive-up option. And I made that poor kid working at Target bring my stuff out to my car. Sometimes I feel like such an asshat when I do stuff like that. But, you know, in the moment, it made me happy. It's no sprawling family estate that I live in. I don't drive a $75,000 car. I don't get foot massages while the help prepares my dinner for me. But it sure as shit beats sitting in a 6x8 cement room for the rest of my life because I had to have a life beyond my means. If nothing else, Alec Murdoch can teach us all a lesson about family, love, gratitude, and humility. And you probably can't get vanilla candles in the jailhouse commissary. So, more power to Alec Murdoch. Let's see our way out of this episode with Alec's sentencing. And I'll leave you with my parting words, as I always do. Until next time, sweet dreams.
No comment. The defendant would like to address the court, then.
Mr. Murdoch.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm innocent. I would never hurt my wife, Maggie, and I would never hurt my son, Paw-Paw.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Sit down.
Yep.
Anything further?
I don't think further comment is necessary, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Murdoch, you have come before the court for sentencing. This has been perhaps one of the most troubling cases, not just for me as a judge, for the state, for the defense team, but for all of the citizens in this community, all the citizens in this state, and as we've seen based on the media coverage throughout the nation, you have a wife who's been killed, murdered, a son savagely murdered. A lawyer, a person from a respected family who has controlled justice in this community for over a century. A person whose grandfather's portrait hang at the back of the courthouse that I had to have ordered removed in order to ensure that a fair trial was had by both the state and the defense. And I've sat through the trial. Not only have I sat through the trial, but also as the presiding judge of the state grand jury sat through and participated in the issuance of search warrants of various sorts, bond hearings, and have had to consider many things. And we have this case, and I'm also assigned to preside over, is it 99 others? At least 99 other cases. Though testimony has come up regarding many of those other cases, I will not make any comment with regard to any other pending matter, as I have been assigned those cases as well. It's also particularly troubling, Mr. Murdaugh, because as a member of the legal community and a well-known member of the legal community, you've practiced law before me, and we've seen each other at various occasions throughout the years. And it was especially heartbreaking for me to see you go in the media from being a grieving father who lost a wife and a son to being the person indicted and convicted of killing them. And you've engaged in such duplicitous conduct here in the courtroom, here on the witness stand, and as established by the testimony throughout the time leading from the time of the indictment and prior to the indictment throughout the trial to this moment in time, certainly you have no obligation to say anything other than saying not guilty. And obviously, as appeals are probably expected or absolutely expected, I would not expect a confession of any kind. In fact, as I've presided over murder cases over the past 22 years, I have yet to find a defendant who could go there, who could go back to that moment in time when they decided to pull the trigger or to otherwise murder someone. I have not been able to get anyone, any defendant, even those who have confessed to being guilty, to go back and explain to me what happened at that moment in time when they opted to pull the trigger, when they opted to commit the most heinous crimes known to man. In this case, qualifies under our death penalty statute based on the statutory aggravating circumstances of two or more people being murdered by the defendant by one act or pursuant to one scheme or course of conduct. I don't question at all the decision of the state not to pursue the death penalty. But as I sit here in this courtroom and look around the many portraits of judges and other court officials and reflect on the fact that over the past century, your family, including you, have been prosecuting people here in this courtroom, and many have received the death penalty, probably for lesser conduct. Remind me of the expression you gave on the witness stand. Was it tangled?
Tangled web, we weave.
Oh, what tangled web we weave. What did you mean by that?
I meant when I lied, I continue to lie.
And the question is, when will it end? When will it end? And it's ended already for the jury because they've concluded that you continue to lie and lie throughout your testimony. And perhaps with all the throng of people here, they, for the most part, all believe, or 80%, 99% believe that you continue to lie now when your statement of denial to the court. Perhaps you believe that it does not matter, that there's nothing that can mitigate a sentence given the crimes that were committed. You know, a notice of alibi was filed in this case by counsel in November, and we conducted a hearing, pretrial hearing, in which you claimed to have been someplace else at the time the crime was committed. Then, after all of the witnesses placed you at the scene of the crime, at the last minute, or last minutes or days, you switched courses and admitted to being there. And then that necessitated more lies and continued to lie. And I said, where will it end? It's already ended for many who have heard you and concluded that it'll never end. But within your own soul, you have to deal with that. And I know you have to see Paul and Maggie during the night times when you're attempting to go to sleep. I'm sure they come and visit you. I'm sure.
All day and every night.
I'm sure. And they will continue to do so. And reflect on the last time they looked you in the eyes, as you looked the jury in the eyes. I don't know a person who's always been such a gregarious, friendly person, and cause your life to be tangled in such a weave, web, such a situation that you yours have spun into. And it's so unfortunate. Because you had such a lovely family of such friendly people, and including you, and to go from that to this. You know, your license to practice law has been stripped away from you. You turned from lawyer to witness. And now have an opportunity to make your final appeal as an ex-lawyer. And it's almost, it's really surprising that you're waiving this right at this time. And if you opt to do so, it's on you. You're not compelled to say anything. But you have the opportunity to do so.
And I tell you again, I respect this court, but I'm innocent. I would never, under any circumstances, hurt my wife, Maggie, and I would never, under any circumstances, hurt my son, Paul.
Well, and it might not have been you. It might have been the monster you become when you take 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 opioid pills. Maybe you become another person. I've seen that before. The person standing before me was not the person who committed the crime, though it's the same individual. We'll leave that at that. Before announcing sentence on these cases, with regard to all of the other pending cases, are any of them here in Culloden, or I'm sure some of them are?
Yes, sir.
Half of them, or?
I don't have that in front of me, but there are a substantial number of charges here. There's some in Hampton, Orangeburg, Beaufort, Allendale. There may be others that I'm not thinking of right now.
We might have worn out our welcome here in Culloden.
Culloden's been great.
They have been, and I'll take this opportunity to thank Sheriff Hill and all of the court officials and really everyone I've met and dealt with while here in Culloden County. Just been great. But without any delay, we're going to schedule some of the other matters.
Yes,
I know Mr. Harpootlian's scheduling is complicated, and you sacrificed quite a bit to be able to be here defending Mr. Murdaugh, as well as the Attorney General's office, with all the other many, many things and obligations you have. And to be able to have the Attorney General here, Alan Wilson, for the period of time that he's devoted to being here along with everyone else, it's been quite a sacrifice. But there are other victims whose cases deserve to be heard, and this case has jumped some of those other cases. Perhaps jumped it because of this case resulting in an assault on the integrity of the judicial system in our state, law enforcement in our state. Even during this trial, the law enforcement had been maligned for the past 5 or 6 weeks by one who had access to the wheels of justice to be able to deflect the investigation, and as the evidence is pointed out in this case, the looming storm that Mr. Waters talked about, I can just imagine on that day, June 7th, when a lawyer is confronted and confesses to having stolen over $500,000 from a client, and he has a tiger like Mark Tinsley on his tail pursuing discovery in the case involving the death of Mallory Beach, and having a father, for the most part, on his deathbed. I could imagine, or really can't imagine, but I know it had to have been quite a bit going through your mind on that day. But amazingly, to have you come and testify that it was just another ordinary day, that my wife and son and I were out just enjoying life. Not credible, not believable. You can convince yourself about it, but obviously you have the inability to convince anyone else about that. So if you made any such arguments as a lawyer, you would lose every case that, like that. Cases you will never have an opportunity to argue anymore, except perhaps your own, as you sit in the Department of Corrections. Anything further?
No, sir.
All right, Mr. Murdoch, I sentence you to the State Department of Corrections on each of the murder indictments in the murder of your wife, Maggie Murdoch. I sentence you for the term of the rest of your natural life for the murder of Paul Murdoch, whom you probably loved so much. I sentence you to prison for murdering him for the rest of your natural life. Those sentences will run consecutive under the statute involving possession of a weapon during a violent crime. There is no sentence where a life sentence is imposed on other indictments. That is the sentence of the court, and you are remanded to the State Department of Corrections. And officers may carry forth on the imposition.